moving here was so refreshing because nobody asked what I was working on. Nobody cared that I was a writer, and nobody really understood what that meant for me. And so for me, that was incredibly freeing. And getting to become friends with people who were like my parents' age, you know, all of the multiple friendships that I got to form here and that are really genuine, they also broke open my notion of like what rural America looked like.
It's Shelf Life. In this episode, a woman wakes up to discover that she's written the complete works of the 19th century French poet Charles Baudelaire in Lisa Robertson's The Baudelaire Fractal. That's one of the reading choices of my guest, Jennifer Cabot, whose memoir, The Eighth Moon, explores a forgotten populist uprising right here in the Catskills.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. President Trump is saying that a peace deal with Iran is close and Israel should not have struck Hezbollah targets in Beirut this morning. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, though, says he's still optimistic.
From all I know, we are on track. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. There's logistics involved into how these things happen. Ultimately, obviously, we're attuned to what's happening with Hezbollah firing rockets into northern Israel, which they need to stop doing, and Iran needs to encourage them to stop doing that in very adamant ways. And Israel was very measured in its response, understanding that a deal we're on the verge of a deal.
Hegseth spoke on CBS Face the Nation. Both U.S. and Iranian officials say an agreement to end the war is close, although the exact day it might be signed is in dispute. Iranian state media report that a delegation of Qatari officials who've been key mediators is in Tehran. Meanwhile, there's a growing chorus of criticism in both Iran and Israel about what an end to the war would mean. NPR's Kerry Khan has more.
Officially, Israel, which was not part of the negotiation, says it supports a deal. But a source familiar with the details who isn't authorized to speak publicly tells NPR that Israel is unhappy. Among the reasons, the source says the plan would require Israel to end its campaign against Hezbollah in Lebanon, and it doesn't give clear enough answers regarding the handling of Iran's enriched uranium. Conservative members of Iran's parliament are critical, too. One member said it subjugates Iran, which would, quote, become a colony of America. And the Speaker of the Parliament lashed out at the deal, suggesting the U.S. can't be trusted to control Israel. He posted on social media just after an Israeli airstrike hit a Beirut suburb on Sunday. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
In a first-of-its-kind operation, Britain's armed forces detained a sanctioned oil tanker in the English Channel, the vessel suspected of being part of Russia's shadow fleet used to ship oil in breach of sanctions imposed over Moscow's war in Ukraine. Vicky Barker has details.
Britain's defense ministry says Royal Marine commandos and specially trained law enforcement officers boarded the tanker Smirtos during a six-hour operation overnight. In a statement, Prime Minister Keir Starmer said the operation, quote, reminds those fueling Putin's war in Ukraine that they cannot hide. It is the first time the UK has actually acted on its threat, issued in March, to board and detain any Russian ships in UK waters. And it comes days after Britain's defense secretary quit over Starmer's refusal to increase spending on a military widely seen as overstretched and under-resourced. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
This is NPR. Bedlam in New York City last night, riots in the streets and a shooting in Times Square as the New York Knicks defeated the Spurs in San Antonio to win the NBA title 94-90 in Game 5 of the NBA Finals. Jeff London reports on the first Knicks title since 1973.
The drought is over. After 53 years, the New York Knicks are NBA champions again. And in Midtown Manhattan, there were spontaneous cheers as fans in orange and blue streamed onto the streets. The Knicks, as they are wont to do, trailed the San Antonio Spurs going into the fourth quarter. But series MVP Jalen Brunson helped clinch the win with 45 points, 15 in the last 12 minutes. Mayor Zoran Mamdani announced a ticker tape parade for Thursday. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
President Trump marks his 80th birthday today. He'll be entertained with a UFC cage fighting event on the South Lawn of the White House. It's also in honor of the nation's 250th anniversary. After the evening's events, the president will leave for France for the G7 summit of industrialized nations. China is not a G7 participant, although there will be plenty of talk about its economic might when the leaders meet in France. Wednesday, French President Macron plans to host the president at a special dinner at the Palace of Versailles to celebrate, he says, the long history of Franco-American friendship. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bank of America, sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, dedicated to offering solutions to help businesses win locally and globally. More at bankofamerica.com/gamechangers.
Moving here was so refreshing because nobody asked what I was working on. Nobody cared that I was a writer, and nobody really understood what that meant for me. And so for me, that was incredibly freeing. And getting to become friends with people who were like my parents' age, you know, all of the multiple friendships that I got to form here and that are really genuine, they also broke open my notion of like what rural America looked like.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. Memoir meets history meets politics in Jennifer Cabot's book, The Eighth Moon, a fascinating account of moving to the Catskills in 2005 and stumbling on a history of America's forgotten populist uprising, the anti-rent war, that culminated in 1845 with the murder of a police officer, Osmond Steele. Drawing on archives, conversations, and her many hikes through the countryside, Cabot favors a writing style that feels akin to an overflowing mind, moving back and forth between eras and observations, daring the reader to keep pace. You could say something similar of Lisa Robertson's The Baudelaire Fractal, the 2020 novel that Cabot has chosen to discuss today. Her other pick is Culture and Anarchy by the poet Adrienne Rich. Jennifer, welcome to Shelf Life.
Thank you so much for having me, Aaron. You are such a delightful reader, and I'm thrilled to be here with you.
Well, I hope I can live up to that billing. I want to start by asking you, what are the key ingredients for a good read for you? What are you looking for when you pick up a book?
So I write kind of experimentally, which might be a way of trying to write to the way my mind experiences the world, where everything is interlinked. And so I'm very interested in other books that, instead of seeing a kind of linear path through things, maybe trace different ways of relating subjects. That might be time. It might be writing against plot. Sometimes it's a way of kind of staking out a feminist terrain. Right now on my desk, I have Jonathan Latham's Brooklyn crime novel, Heather McCaldin's The Observable Universe. And both of those are sort of written in fragments about places. And so they both are kind of ways of sort of breaking apart a story, in a sense. Mm. And sometimes being written in fragments can be very pacey.
Well, we'll talk about that in relation to The Eighth Moon, which is definitely fragmentary quite often. You call it a memoir on the cover, but it's also a history of the rent strikes in 1845. A meditation on nature, a critique of capitalism that finds parallels between 1845 and the present. It definitely plays with form. You summon these historical characters practically into being. They sort of live on the page. You use historical documents, but also a lot of poetic license. When did that shape for The Eighth Moon occur to you?
So I am somebody who I love history, and sort of it feels a bit like an inhabitation for me. And so the characters in it, the more I did research, the more they felt alive to me, as if they were kind of zooming through me. It's this weird feeling of the past vibrating into the present. But I also start the eighth moon with a shootout in a corral and drag. And I mean, who can like resist like messing with the Western form in a way? And also like the drama of that, like it's a kind of thing, a shootout in a corral, you know, it's every Western we've ever seen. But it's like, oh yes, here it is in my town too. And it's a true story and it's in drag and all the lawmen are wearing corsets. To me, that's irresistible.
Well, let's talk about that shootout in the upstate Catskills corral that you now have made home. You moved to the Catskills from London and you were hiking near Margaretville when you come across a historical marker. Describe that historical marker and the path it sent you down.
Well, I was actually cycling, so I was on a bike. And the historical marker is on the Tremperskill, which is a road and a route through Andes. And it's like 1 mile to the site where Osmond Steele was shot. And I was like, that's interesting. Like, what does this mean? And, you know, there's this thing about historical markers. They kind of disappear into the landscape. Most people don't stop to see them. So I rode my bike around, past it a lot. And then finally, I got really curious about like, why was a lawman shot in 1845, 1 mile to the site? And so I wanted to learn about that story. And I also wanted to learn about the land I live on and the place and what it means. And I had kind of heard about the anti-rent war, but it was very vague. And Andes, which is the neighboring town, which is where the shootout occurred, celebrates its community day on the second Saturday of August every year. And the community day is actually the weekend closest to the day Osmond Steele was shot. So basically, here's this town that's having its community celebration, like there's a parade, the fire department's there, there are kids out, there's face painting, all of the like celebratory town fete activities, but because a cop was shot. And I found that fascinating. And I wanted to understand more. And this history is both very legible, but also not super discussed. Nobody talks about the fact that a cop was shot or why. So that was really what kicked off my curiosity about it.
And when you start investigating, you turn to archives, you spend a lot of time in the library, you look at a lot of old newspapers. How did you stumble on the peculiar culture of the anti-rent strikes? I think they called themselves Calico Indians. What was their reason for that?
Yeah, they called themselves Calico Indians. And in their moment, it wasn't as problematic as it is in ours. You know, I write this book in a perpetual present tense because I want that moment to be alive. Because here are these people who, in the most radical vision they're trying to set out, was to both redistribute all the land so there was no land ownership at all and to have no centralized government, which is basically socialist anarchism before that language existed. And so, you know, here I am a socialist and there's a socialist uprising in my town. This is hidden history. Of course, I love that. I want it to exist now. But lo and behold, here are these people appropriating indigenous identities, which is very problematic. You know, the reasons that they did it are not entirely legible to me. I have plenty of friends whose forebears were part of that uprising. One who even has one of those disguises that his relative wore. But nobody really knows exactly the reason. My guess from the conversations I've had and the reading I've done is that it's both some kind of way to do illegal activities and not get caught. Like you're masking so nobody would know who you are and wearing a dress so nobody could see your clothes to identify you. But then there's a second part where they want land. So they are trying to set themselves out as the true inheritors of the land, as if they are the indigenous residents themselves. And that part is super problematic because, of course, at this very moment that this uprising is happening, it begins in the very end of the 1830s and it goes to sort of the mid-1840s. is when the U.S. is stealing a lot of indigenous land, not just as part of the Trail of Tears in the South, but also across New York State. You know, Buffalo, New York was Seneca land until 1842. So here are these people trying to make land theirs. At the same time, the government is stealing land. I don't think the disguises and the federal government's actions and this quest for land are separate at all. And, you know, the anti-rent war, that uprising, eventually became the Free Soil Movement, which became one of the first planks of the Republican Party and then became the Homestead Act. So these outfits are not neutral. They don't not mean something, even if the meanings are hard to untangle.
So you have a populist rebellion, essentially, that you have a lot of fellow feeling for, sympathy for. The goal is initially land redistribution. But this is America. Everywhere you walk in the Catskills, everywhere you walk upstate, there are posted signs and private property signs. I would say in some ways we might be further away from the goals of those men and women in 1845 than ever.
Yes, there is so much private property here. And like there are like the posted signs. And sometimes the posted signs are actually a bit of legalese, if that makes sense. If you have a posted sign and somebody trespasses on your land, it's so that you don't get sued if they injure themselves. But it's interesting. So here's this movement that sets out to be this really radical socialist thing. And here we are 180 years later with all this private property. And in fact, the majority of the Catskills is owned by New York City for its watershed. So in some ways, that is a public land for a public reason and has its own set of issues. And it's interesting, like that uprising, I became interested in it partly because it looks so much like Trumpism. It looks so much like the political conditions of our moment. And I started researching it just around when Trump was first elected, just after the shooting in Charleston. So these moments had happened. And I was also trying to figure out, well, what does it mean to be a person who lives in rural America? To be a kind of leftist who lives here when the country was sort of tacking further and further to the right. And so what did my participation in rural America look like? And then digging into my community and realizing that the farmer down the road from me named his first son Lincoln at a time when the Civil War was deeply unpopular and that he'd been part of this uprising, it was like, oh, maybe I do fit here. And then starting to see that moment where there was so much rage, and a lot of the talk was about trying to finish the American Revolution and blah, 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 all this stuff that sounds very Tea Party. And I was like, oh yeah, people are still angry. People still feel unrepresented in rural America, that there is something from that moment and this moment that are in common. And so it gave me a way to understand the rage of this moment, if that makes sense.
Yeah. One of the questions that sort of percolated for me throughout this book is whether in much the same way that descendants of men who fought for the Unionists in the Civil War might now fly a Confederate flag from their land or from the back of their truck, whether some of the descendants of the anti-rent rebellion were now MAGA supporters.
I think that that's totally true. I mean, the book does have a plot. It's like, Lady leaves London and moves to Margaretville. Lady joins volunteer fire department. So there's a storyline. It's very thin. but in my fire department, I am so used to learning MAGA memes or the person who comes in wearing the Trump 2020 Make Liberals Cry Again t-shirt, even though we sort of have a no politics rule. So I see it very clearly, the connections. Like there's this moment in the book where I learned to shoot. A local cop teaches me to shoot. And the local cop happens to be a New York City water police officer. And I'm trying to learn to shoot to write a crime novel. And we're here in a field shooting at tin cans. And he's quoting to me Noam Chomsky. And he's saying, why aren't we organizing them? And really, that is the question that I have, which is that both of these uprisings are about not being represented and not being represented by kind of US capitalism. Like if we look at this moment, the real incomes for most people in America have gone down. The quality of life in rural America is increasingly hard. There are like healthcare crises, there are drug crises, there are income crises. All of those things are very real. And a lot of kind of coastal political commentators don't actually see those struggles. Because as a country, we give a lot of money to rural America. But, you know, those two things aren't the same. And part of the problem is that there is no one really talking about those needs.
Mm. I want to stick with that crime novel you were writing since you brought it up. You learned to shoot. What happens to the crime novel? Why did you put it away?
Oh, it sucked. It was so bad. Like I do love really pacey writing, I have to say. I do like a shootout in a corral. I love scene. I love plot. Despite the fact that I write against plot, I love dialogue. I like the things that set up enjoyable reading. And I like to use them in my work. However, the how we get from one moment to another became very sclerotic, super constipated, if we could call a book that, and stuck. And I couldn't do it. It was dreadful. Like, it just didn't work. Although I do have a small fantasy about going back and revisiting it. Like, you know, I do like experimental fiction. I was like, oh, I could write the experimental crime novel now, you know.
Didn't Paul Auster try that?
Yes, I definitely will not be as good as Paul Auster. You know, that's a high bar.
I'm Aaron Hicklin. This is Shelf Life. My guest is the author Jennifer Cabot. Her book, The Eighth Moon, A Memoir of Belonging and Rebellion, is out now. Jennifer, I sense some guilt in the book about your place in this community and your background, your story. Is that guilt warranted? Should we feel guilty for making our lives here?
You know, there are two answers to this. Like, one is the Catskills is always a place that has had outsiders. Mm. It has long been a tourist destination since the earliest parts of the 19th century when people were coming to Catterskill Falls. So tourists and outsiders and that sort of back and forth between the city and upstate has a very, very long and very rich and important history. And in a way, pretty much every white person here is like a gentrifier. Like, this is indigenous land. It is like Muncie land. It is Mohawk land. Those histories are pretty legible if you look. So that's the first answer that I have to that. And the second one is like, yeah, we should feel a little guilty. You know, we live in a community where, at least in my community, there's a housing crisis right now. And that housing crisis is very real. Like, there is no affordable housing. And it is also part of a larger system where it totally makes sense that somebody in Brooklyn who is priced out of buying in Brooklyn buys a house in the Catskills because they can afford it. And then it would make sense, too, that they would Airbnb that house to offset, say, their property tax or their fuel bill for their heating oil, whatever it is. Mm. All of that makes sense. But the system has led to a housing crisis. And that housing crisis has huge knock-on effects. Like, I am a first responder, and I'm a first responder partly because there weren't enough people. And part of why there aren't enough people is because the people who would normally do that can't afford to live here. So it is messy, you know, and part of that problem is like, if you're in the New York City watershed, the city owns so much land that it's hard to develop more housing. So it's a really complex problem. And I think we should all have a little bit of anxiety about it or introspection.
Mm-hmm. But you've lived there now for 20 years, almost 20 years. How have you changed in that time in terms of your status in that community or how you feel welcomed within that community?
I mean, I love living here. And one of the things that I loved about moving here when I came originally from London, like when I moved to Margaretville, is a very working class village. It wasn't cute and bucolic, so there weren't weekenders really there yet. And we were also the youngest people in town. And so my life suddenly became really diverse. Like, it was intergenerational. Like, living in London, like, as you probably remember from London, like, you can just socialize with people who, like, reflect you in every way. Like, all my friends in London were the same kind of striving, intellectual, creative people. And it was like, moving here was so refreshing because nobody asked what I was working on. Nobody cared that I was a writer. And nobody really understood what that meant for me. And so for me, that was incredibly freeing. And getting to become friends with people who were like my parents' age, you know, all of the multiple friendships that I got to form here and that are really genuine, they also broke open my notion of like what rural America looked like. Just like the cop who's quoting Noam Chomsky. And I come from a family where my father spent his entire life working in rural America. So I don't know why I was thinking rural America would be some bastion of conservatism, but it did.
One of the things I love about this book is the way that your parents find their way into the fabric of the pages. They sort of haunt this book in really lovely ways. They were both socialists. How did that influence your development, your sort of philosophy, do you think?
Well, you know, when you're a kid, your family life just seems like normal. So my parents spent their entire lives working in co-ops and, like, you know, our grapefruit juice had to come from a cooperative. Like, our mid-century modern furniture came from a co-op. Everything was bought by a co-op because serve and blah, blah, blah. And then as a teenager, as I was rebelling against my parents, I would dismiss them as pragmatic Marxists. I was like the brattiest kid. So I didn't think my dad was a real Marxist or a real socialist because he was too pragmatic. He was very willing to have lunch with Republican senators if it would further the co-op cause. So here I am in middle age, like my parents are older and dying. I'm like the youngest kid by a generation in my family. And so I find myself living not far from where they first managed a rural co-op. And somehow my life came to feel like a palimpsest in their lives. I was sort of reenacting part of their lives or trying to inhabit their vision of the world. Like, their vision of the world started to seem increasingly heroic to me, particularly in the kind of political climate of America today.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with Jennifer Cabot, the author of The Eighth Moon, a memoir of belonging and rebellion. Jennifer, we were talking about your mother and father there. Your mother raised you on folk songs about protest and the poor. You write in The Eighth Moon. Why do you think that protest songs seem to have sort of withered? You reference so many protest songs from 1845 and onwards, and I remember them even in the 1980s, whether it was Free Nelson Mandela by the Special AKA or Billy Bragg or NWA, no shortage of them. But I actually have a hard time identifying a protest song from the last decade.
Yeah, it was funny. As I read through the testimony from 1845 after the shooting of Osmond Steele, so the cop who shot in the corral, so there's all this testimony. There are a lot of protest songs that are mentioned. Somebody mentions people going and singing a song from the old country, which was a song about enlisting. And there's another moment where somebody is like being marched off to prison, to Dannemora, which is still a high security prison in upstate New York. And he is being marched through Catskill, New York, and somebody sings Old Dan Tucker. Now, I had never heard Old Dan Tucker, but of course, Bruce Springsteen has a version of it. So these songs do continue to exist. And what is wild is to see the different language put to them. Or, you know, in my town, there's Jay Gould's Daughter, which is, of course, about the robber baron Jay Gould, who is from Roxbury, New York.
Well, let's stay with Jay Gould, because I think in chapter 17, at the beginning of that chapter, you introduce a photo beautifully described in which two young men stare directly into the camera. Your attention is held by the young man on the right, extremely handsome, thick tousled hair, what looks like velvet pants, the high collar of the era. You note that it's in fact Jay Gould, the legendary robber baron who watered stocks and spurred a run on gold after the Civil War that sparked a recession. He studied at the Hobart Academy in Hobart, now known as the Book Village, which is close to Margaretville, where you live today. And he would, in fact, write one of the earliest histories of the anti-rent war in his History of Delaware County. How would you describe Gould's account of that rebellion?
First, can I just talk about that picture for a second? He is so hot in that picture. Yeah. So Jay Gould, who went on to become the very famous robber baron. If anybody's been watching The Gilded Age, the main character on The Gilded Age is modeled after Jay Gould. And his family still has a huge presence in the Catskills where I live. But he wrote this book, This History of the Catskills, in the 1850s. And it includes a very detailed account of the anti-rent war, to which he was very opposed. In that account, there's actually this personal moment where he recounts somebody taking out somebody, holding a gun to his head, and the little kid being scared that his father was going to die. And that little kid is Jay Gould, who at that point was 9 or 10 years old. And his father was uprent, so believed that the feudal system of the Catskills and all of upstate New York was just. And, you know, if I were a little kid and my dad was about to be shot in front of my eyes, I probably would write against that uprising too.
Jay Gould's dad did not get shot, but Osmond Steele did. That was the death that you first spotted commemorated on a plaque not too far from where you live in Margaretville. What happened to his murderer and what happened to him? Did he die instantly?
He didn't die instantly. He died about 12 hours later. So he's the undersheriff, and he was somebody who also was deeply unpopular. He tortured the anti-renters. He tortured their wives. Like, he chased them down in the middle of the night. He was very vociferous in his attacks. So he was super unpopular, and he had red hair, and they, you know, were like, yeah, your red hair is not going to be red. It's going to be blood. Like, there were all these kinds of violent things said about him. But I should say he was arrested for battering a woman a few years before the anti-rent war. So he was not a good guy either. He didn't deserve to get shot. Nobody does, but not a good guy. So he dies about 12 hours later. He's carried into the house, to Moses Earle's house. So Moses Earle is a farmer who has refused to pay his rent. And nobody knows who shot whom or how. It could have been friendly fire. You know, Osmond Steele and the other deputy who is there are both shooting their guns. The anti-renters are shooting their guns. And eventually two men are arrested, but nobody actually thinks they did it. And the person who probably had the greatest amount of culpability was a person named Warren Scudder, who was in charge of the anti-renters that day. But he flees first to Schoharie, the county just north of me, and then to Canada. So he can't be brought to justice. So they bring to justice these two other people.
Well, let's talk about your peregrinations around the Catskills. You're often outside in this book. I mentioned at the beginning that it's a sort of meditation on nature. You have a rich understanding or vocabulary on the flora of the area. It really is a pretty central part of the Eighth Moon. And through that, I guess, our relationship to nature living here.
I was a weirdo lonely kid. I mean, I was like the lonely kid who had a crush on Adrienne Rich and John Ruskin. But I was also the lonely kid who was sent outside when I was little to identify flowers. So we spent our 2 weeks of vacation every year in Vermont. And I had parents who were pretty old. And I was like a young, rambunctious kid. And so they would be like, go pick some flowers, kiddo, and then identify them. Like, I've always been very aware of plants and flowers. They've always had a very special place for me. I'm pretty obsessed with the language and the names. Like, there are all these histories in them. Some of it, yes, I learned living here. Like, on the land I live on, there's this very beautiful flower which is a closed bottle gentian. Mm. And for a long time, that was going to be the title of the book, is gentian, because it's this wild flower. It's Yves Klein blue. It's like this electric purple. And it comes out at the very end of summer and it never opens. So it's closed to outsiders. It needs a specialized pollinator, like one special bee that can basically push its way in. And it never opens to protect its sexual parts. And it's a species of concern. And I was like, yes, that is my flower. Like, so for a long time, I was using that as the title so that that flower could basically be the stand-in for me or whatever. And it's like a book about walking and like finding things and learning about like the eft, which is this little salmon-colored salamander. But, you know, it turns out the eft can replace all its body parts, maybe even its heart. So all of these things became metaphors, like, or ways to write into the place.
And I think I gave you a little heads up shortly before we started recording that I wanted to ask you about being a herbalist. I actually have right in front of me a tincture that you sent to me just before this year's Deep Water Literary Festival, which you were part of, to keep me calm. Tell me a little about that exploration of flora as a way to heal ourselves.
I trained as an herbalist in the pandemic. It was just like, you know, the pandemic was this wild time for reinvention. And I didn't do it because I wanted to treat anybody. I don't feel a great medical calling in the world, but I was really curious to learn another language of plants. And herbalism has a kind of oral history. Most of our medicines come from things in the world, like aspirin comes from birch bark and aspen bark. And I was just curious to learn this other language that was mostly oral and to see what it did. And then as maybe also a way of relating to this place and the land. And there are some things where like herbalism is like a great way to treat things. Like if you have Lyme disease, you should definitely take the doxycycline. But, you know, there are other herbal things that are really great to take in conjunction with that, that will help you respond better to the antibiotics and reach some of the deeper parts of the spirochetes, which I might not be pronouncing correctly, of Lyme disease. So I've come to know more about the very medical parts of it, but it wasn't what I was interested in. It was more a way of like knowing or understanding plants and their history and the language. And some of it was just like the first plant I became most obsessed with and its medical uses is Queen Anne's lace, because the seeds from Queen Anne's lace, which is a wild carrot, like you can eat the root, but don't go eat the root unless you're sure it's what it is, because it looks like poison hemlock too. So don't go experimenting with this unless you're sure. But the seeds are a progesterone inhibitor and you can take the seeds as a morning after pill. And I was like, that is rad. And you know, obviously we're in a moment where women's bodily autonomy is like under threat. So I'm very interested in what are the plants that women have used to empower themselves to control their fertility and to make decisions about their lives. Because, you know, you can be sure that women have always been finding ways to control when and how they give birth.
Well, we'll talk a little more about women's bodily autonomy when we discuss Adrienne Rich after this break. I'm talking with the author, Jennifer Cabot. Her book is The Eighth Moon, a memoir of belonging and rebellion. We'll be back after this.
I'm Meg Wolitzer, and this week on Selected Shorts, we celebrate the O. Henry Prize stories with Pulitzer-winning author Edward P. Jones. Follow every narrative twist and turn with actors such as Morgan Spector of The Gilded Age. Join us.
Selected Shorts, Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Boots Riley, an Oakland-based filmmaker and founding member of the seminal hip-hop group, The Coup. In films like Sorry to Bother You, Riley brings a surrealist style to politically charged stories. His newest, I Love Boosters, features an all-star cast. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Jennifer Cabot, the author of The Eighth Moon, a memoir of belonging and rebellion, which is set in and around her home in Margaretville in the Catskills. Jennifer, you were talking about writing this book, The Eighth Moon, as a book about coming into community. And I can't help thinking that's a great entree into the Adrian Rich poem you've chosen to talk about culture and anarchy. Tell me about your experience with this poem.
You know, it's funny, like, one, I reread it today and I was like, oh, wow, there are parts of this poem that I don't think I noticed then. Or maybe I did, but like, I see them anew. The thing that I loved as a teenager reading this was the way, like, she breathed life into these voices as if they were contemporary, as if that history was part of her present tense. And I found it really startling. Like, to me, it was like a way of doing history that felt so alive and felt very partisan and particular, and a way to look for antecedents. And at the same time, it was woven in amongst her life with her lover and partner, who she lives with at this point. And so I found it just like refreshing. You know, you're a teenager, you do history. And so here was this version of the world that seemed like recapturing something that I wanted to be part of. And the voices were really moving as she brought them into the book. And I probably didn't even understand its relationship to Matthew Arnold very well. I was just like, oh, these women's voices.
Tell me a little about that relationship to Matthew Arnold. What should we be looking for when we read this poem?
Oh, gosh. So I'm going to give you a really bad answer, which is that I actually had to Wikipedia Matthew Arnold this morning just to make sure I could remember. I feel like I was much smarter at 15 than I am in my 50s. So Matthew Arnold was a very, very famous Victorian poet and essayist. And as a poet, I guess he's pretty middling. As an essayist, he wrote this book, Culture and Anarchy, that has a little bit of culture war prominence right now. On the left might be a little eh, and on the right, a little bit like, we love this. And in it, he is really thinking about like, where culture sort of exists as a salvation for all. He was a school inspector, and he was also going to all these non-conforming schools. So visiting schools all across the UK, often in very impoverished districts. And he saw culture as a kind of inherent truth as well, which is, I think, where the sort of culture war moment happens in today's moment. But he saw that culture could be something that was for everyone. And that's a really radical idea, the idea that culture is for everyone, that it isn't exclusive. And so Adrienne Rich here is clearly writing a rejoinder to him. And she is writing about the women's lives who have fallen outside of culture, whose voices, and even though these are pretty famous women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, say, they're writing in opposition and they're writing at the same times that Matthew Arnold is writing.
I think this would be a really great moment to get a flavor of the poem. Are you able to find a section to read? I'm not sure we want to read all of it, but let's have a go and see where we get to.
It is a beautiful poem. Like, I want to read from two different parts of it if I could. I love the beginning because it starts with the plants and the plants in her world. Leaf shade stirring on lichened bark. Daylilies run wild. Escaped, the botanists call it, from dooryard to meadow to roadside. Life tingle of angled light. Late summer sharpening toward fall. Each year more sharply. This headlong loved escaping life. Rainy days at the kitchen table typing. Heaped up letters, a dry moth's perfectly mosaiced wings. Pamphlets on rape. Forced sterilization, snapshots in color of an Alabama woman still quilting in her 90s. And then she goes on to quote from Susan B. Anthony, but I actually want to move on to a different section. Like, I just love that moment where she sets out the world around her. Haze wiping out the hills, mornings like milk, the mind waiting, treading water, the line of vision blind. The pages of the book cling to the hand. Words hang in a suspension. The prism hanging in the window frame is blank. a stillness building all day long to thunder. As the weed pod swells and thickens, no one can call this calm. Jane Addams, marking time in Europe. During most of that time, I was absolutely at sea, so far as any moral purpose was concerned, clinging only to the desire to live in a really living world, refusing to be content with a shadowy intellectual or aesthetic reflection. Finally, the bursting of the sky, power, release.
Thank you, Jennifer. I should say that because I have your annotated version from when you were 15, you've made my life quite easy because you've underlined lots of things. I wonder if you can help us figure out what the poet Adrienne Rich is doing here.
You know, it's funny, like I was reading this again today and I was like reading about the escaped anarchist daylilies above. And I think, you know, here is this thing, there's this moment of like great beauty, the dry moth's wings, the escaped flowers, late summer sharpening to fall, which is like this moment that we're talking right now is like that moment. So I feel like we can see that world that she is rendering around us so beautifully, which is why when I was reading it this morning, I was like, oh my gosh. And then she gets to these really violent images, the pamphlets on rape, forced sterilization, snapshots in color. And so she's trying to make sense of her world and the beauty in it and that world. You know, my guess is she's thinking about J. Marion Sims, who is the father of obstetrics and gynecology and who like practiced his art on enslaved women, which is where that medicine comes from. So I think she's thinking about the real violence that women faced in the 19th century and what it means to inhabit also a beautiful world, that these two things come together. And in a way, there is this anarchy of her garden and the violence of the culture from the 19th century that she's writing to.
Mm. She was a committed feminist, I should say. And one of the things that strikes me as a kind of parallel with, I think, your philosophy is you were both suspicious of the artist as a kind of singular genius. And this poem, I feel, also serves to refute that notion. In a way, she's sort of coming into community, as you are in this book, but with this lineage of women, women before her, and contemporaries as well.
So like one, Adrienne Rich was like a great friend of like Audre Lorde. You know, she started off writing very pleasant, beautiful poems in the 50s and had great renown. And then in her life, as she came into politics, that became what her poetry was about. And, you know, that actually pissed off a lot of the literary establishment, but she really sought to write a kind of intersectionality in her work way before that became the language that we would use to describe that and to forge these relationships with other radical poets, often queer, and sort of taking what would be called sort of second wave feminism and actually making it very activist. So her poetry is really activist. And sometimes it can be really a little cringy, you know, we read things from the past and it's not always great, but it can also feel incredibly beautiful, particularly when she is trying to cite herself within a greater lineage where she is seeing that what she's doing is part of a kind of like polyvocal world.
Jennifer, let's chat a little about The Baudelaire Fractal by Lisa Robertson. This is your other choice today. It's a wonderful book. I mean, the language in this book is so ripe and fragrant, I should say. You can sort of smell it. It's sort of an essay on Baudelaire, and we shall have to answer the question of whether you need to read Baudelaire to appreciate it. But it's also about Hazel Brown, who sort of sits in really for the author, Lisa Robertson. How did you come across this novel?
So it's published by Coach House, which is a beautiful Canadian press that publishes great poetry and experimental writing. And I think that the publicist emailed me about it. And I was like, well, I love Lisa Robertson's poetry, so send me the book. Like, and it's just one of those books where it's like, it's really funny to me. It begins with this, like, describing herself as Hazel Brown. And I just think that's such a funny name for a main character. Like, Hazel and Brown are sort of bland. Mm. And so there's this blandness in the name that I just find really funny. And it is two eye colors. And of course, there's a doubling of an eye here, because the poet Hazel Brown, who moves to Paris as a young person, yearning to be a poet, but not even understanding what that is, being a kind of girl, and like all of their adventures around clothes and boys and men and life and like all these things, in this kind of striving of her world, is a little bit like the younger me, the same kind of like striving young person I was reading Audrey Rich and John Ruskin and like trying to find my way in the world. Mm. So I really love it, partly because it's this beautiful buildings roman. And then it's a book about Baudelaire. And, you know, I haven't read Baudelaire since college or grad school, so it's been a long time. Mm. I don't think you need to read Baudelaire to appreciate the book. Like, I think she does a pretty good breakdown of his work.
It opens with this wonderful paragraph. Let's hear it.
Raised from babydom into doubt, I'm as feminine as Rousseau. I, Hazel Brown, eldest daughter of a disappearing class, penniless neophyte stunned by the glamour of literature, tradeless, clueless, yet with considerable moral stamina and luck, left my family at 17 to seek a way to live. It was the month of June in 1979. I was looking for beauty. I didn't exactly care about art. I simply wanted not to be bored and to experience grace. So I thought I would write. No other future seemed preferable. Let me be clear. I did not want to admire life. I did not want to skim it. I wanted to swim in it. I judged that to do this, I had to leave and to write. I wanted to speak the beautiful language of my time, but without paying.
And that was Allegra Fulton reading from the Baudelaire Fractal by Lisa Robertson, one of the choices of my guests for this episode of Shelf Life, the author Jennifer Kabat. It's such a great opener. It both feels like a 19th century novel and also deeply playful. I mean, what does it mean to say I'm as feminine as Rousseau?
And I will just say, I don't know what it means to be as feminine as Rousseau, but I wish I could write that paragraph. However, I am pretty sure that Lisa knows, like, I think she reads a lot of Rousseau is my understanding, partly because I also follow her Instagram. So right.
Rousseau, of course, being the great figure of the Enlightenment. What are some of the sections that jumped out at you? What are the parts of this novel that you particularly admire?
Oh, like, where do I start? One, she describes sex beautifully. Like, we do not have enough good sex writers, and she can do that. But then there is how she describes clothing and folds and stains, and she's sort of searching for a feminine poetics. And she has this line at the end, which I actually quote in my book, where she says, "If I could open the temporality in sentences, perhaps a transformation could take hold. It was the simplest idea, but had some inadvertent merit in that it forced me to recognize time as a linguistic material. Therefore, time became my linguistic material." And so for me, as a writer who wants to write against chronology, who wants to find another way to exist on the page, I really latched on to both that language there, but also her quest for time as a linguistic material. And this question of like, well, what could this mean for me as a writer?
Is there a comparison between fiction like this, the Baudelaire Fractal by Lisa Robertson, and the kind of art that we might consider conceptual or a little abstract that is trying to do something new with the form?
Definitely. So she's writing an experimental book. Like, it is clearly a novel, but it is also maybe autofiction, as much as I hate that phrase and how au courant it is. But you could also put her on the same shelf as Elizabeth Hardwick's Sleepless Nights, or even that poem Culture and Anarchy. Like, she's going back to Baudelaire looking for an antecedent for herself. So looking for these kind of feminine, feminist poetics of a kind of woman's world, of a she-dandy is what she calls it. And so I think that there's this world of non-linear writing that is asking us to reconceive how we see a life, or how we see a woman's life, or how we see time in our lives. And the thing that is actually interesting, this sort of like common ground between like Robertson and Rich and Hardwick, these are all writers in middle age. And sort of middle age is this moment where time becomes really slippery. When you're young, time is this huge expanse. And suddenly times become like, you know, I've lived in the Catskills 20 years, like, that time feels like nothing in my life. And so that very psychedelic experience of time, I think, asks for a different kind of accounting on the page, what it could be. All of these books are in some ways feminist questions about how we look at time and life, and like who speaks and how they speak. And I'm really interested in forms that break that open. The novel is a form that was born of capitalism, like it was born of the Industrial Revolution. I think like artistic moments carry something of the moments that created them. Like they transmit something of that to us. And the idea of plot comes with ideas about progress. And like, you know, the entire 19th and a lot of the 20th century, we believe that progress was an inherent truth, as if it was out there as some true thing, as if the world was always going to get better. And progress is a historical creation that's bounded by certain cultural and economic moments. And so is the novel. And so is the kind of like order of a novel. So it's very interesting to me, books that question that order and what that could mean for us as readers, but also how we conceive of our lives and the world and the conversations we have around us. We live in a moment that is particularly non-hierarchical in a lot of ways. Like, it's part of the problem with our politics now. Everything is news. Everything is a truth. All of that stuff is very problematic. But if you think about living in a non-hierarchical relationship to the spaces we're in, we might have a different relationship to the indigenous histories of those places we live. So I'm very interested in what a creative form could do that could ask us to conceive of our world in a different way, like what that might open up.
Jennifer, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me on Shelf Life. I look forward to reading your next book.
Aaron, thank you for having me. You are such a good reader.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking about The Eighth Moon, a memoir of belonging and rebellion, published by Milkweed, The Baudelaire Fractal, by Lisa Robertson, published by Coach House Books, and Culture and Anarchy, a poem by Adrian Rich, which appears in Collected Poems 1950 to 2012, published by W.W. Norton. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in collaboration with Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Helen Phillips, Ari Shapiro, and John Waters. While you're there, please give us a review and a 5-star rating. It can help others find the show.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
Hey everyone, Tom Candela here from Curtain Call. This week on the show, I take a closer look at a remarkable new musical inspired by one of the most pivotal moments in our nation's history. Join me as I welcome composer John Allen Watts, writer Jason Huza, and director Misty Wills for an in-depth conversation about The Crossing, a powerful new work exploring George Washington, Thomas Paine, and ordinary citizens. That's this week on Curtain Call, Monday night at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we just ask the question.
Is that statement true?
Get to the point with NPR every weekday morning.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on Radio Catskill.